Okay, Paul, so we'll just begin. Tole najbolj že veste, Jon Medovhol iz Linux International. Prišel je na konferenco v Portorož jutr, tako da drugač pa v glavnem putuje okrog po svetu, pa
evangelizem.
Tako je.
Jaz mislim, da konferenca lahko traja toliko časa, koliko boste imeli vprašanj, to pomeni, če kar začnemo, bo potem ne, do 3/4, 5, do 4 kitajšnega, do 4, imamo pa toliko časa, pač koliko ga potrebujete. Tako da, it's up to you when you would like to end the conference, I think, because it appears that only two people from the press will be present at this conference, that we can one-to-one explain perhaps what is interesting.
Okay, yeah. So one of the questions I have of them is what type of audience is, where are they from, what type of audience are their readers?
I come from Monitor, that's the main computer magazine in Slovenia. It's basically
very technically oriented.
Okay. Okay.
We also have a segment on business computer systems, big systems.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you are from?
Ljubljanske novice, news from Ljubljana, it's internet magazine. Very broad coverage of everything that goes on in Ljubljana. He's personally interested in Linux.
Okay. Well, actually, I think the two messages I have today for the people are, number one, what Linux is, and if they don't know what Linux is, why there are certain things about Linux that are very important. And the second thing is to business people about why they should be using Linux and what it means for them. The first thing about Linux is the fact that it is an operating system which has lots of dimensions, and it can be multi-architecture, so it can run on Intel and Motorola and StrongARM and a wide variety of different processors. And this is important because no one processor is good for every application. For example, if you stick an Intel Pentium into your PDA, it will drain the batteries in a few seconds. And it will also make the PDA so hot that you'll probably drop it. On the other hand, you don't want to use the processor that's in your PDA in your supercomputer because it's simply too slow. And so an operating system that can span the range of all these different abilities allows you to be able to program it without having to learn yet another set of programming interfaces. It also allows the operating system to bring to a PDA, for instance, the features of a general purpose operating system. And people say, well, why do I care about that? Well, in today's networked world, everything needs to talk to each other. And an operating system like Linux already has the support for all this networking built into it. You have lots of devices that you wish to plug into your PDA. And Linux has a lot of device drivers that have already been written for it. But beyond that, once you make your PDA networked to the rest of the world, it has to be secure, because now all of a sudden everybody can get to your PDA. It has to be just as secure as your desktop or your server system. Your PDA has to do multiple things at one time. If you're listening to music, you don't want to stop listening to music just because you decided to make an entry in your calendar. And so now your PDA has to be multitasking. there's a project in India to create a PDA which people can use as a computer. It's called the Simputer project. And their idea is to take a smart media card and plug it into the Simputer, and that's going to be your personal file system and all of your personal files. So the operating system has to have a certain protection to it, even amongst different users. And these are things that have been built into Unix and Linux systems from the very beginning. And this is one reason why Linux tends to be very stable. It tends to be very secure. It's because these things are built in. And in addition to that, you get all the source code for the operating system, so you get to change it to meet your needs. So that's the first message about Linux and the wide range of things it can do. It runs on PDAs, it runs on desktops, it runs on server systems, and it runs on supercomputers. In fact, 3/4 of all the supercomputers in the world today run Linux. The second message is for business people. And business people say, well, the operating system doesn't cost any money. How good could it be? And the thing is that when we talk about Linux being free, we're not just talking about the fact that you could get it at no cost, but we're talking about the freedom that you get when you get the source code. And why is this important to a business person? Because a lot of banks may never change the source code to the operating system. If you need a fix in a hurry because you can't go forward with a project, and you apply to some company who gives you only closed source proprietary code, it may take them a week or 2 weeks or a month or maybe never before they get back with that fix to you. And as long as that problem exists, you can't go forward with your project. This, as a business person, costs you time and money. Let's say a company would like a small change made to the operating system or the piece of code, just a small change to make it easier for them to do work. If you apply to a large closed source company and say, would you make this change for us? They'd say, well, we'd like to, but we have all these other things we have to do, and your change is going to go to the end of our priority queue. So you have to sit there and wait for this change to be made. And in the meantime, this is costing you time and money. You know, because you don't have this change, you may have to go and train your employees to do something different. Because you don't have this change, maybe your customers are making mistakes. They're ordering the wrong thing. They're receiving frustration in their ordering. And because of this frustration, they go to a different supplier. This costs you time and money. And so this is the message I have for business people, is that open source software gives you a business choice of either living with the issue that exists or using the source code and paying somebody to fix the problem. With open source, you don't have to go back to the person who sold you the software. You can go to an independent consultant. You can go to a VAR. You can go to a college student who has the expertise and get them to make the change for you. Or perhaps your own employees can do it. But you have the source code, so you can make that choice. When you have closed source proprietary code, you don't have a choice. You have to do whatever the vendor gives you. Now, a lot of people think that I'm talking about Microsoft when I said this. And a lot of people say Linux people are against Microsoft. But it's really any closed source proprietary company. They all have the same problem. And the problem is that they have a small number of engineers that are trying to produce code that works for a large group of people. And the larger the group of customers they have, the more those customers are likely to run into a bug, where number two have some small change they want to have made to make their business run easier, and they can't get it made. So when you start your company, you may have 50 engineers and 100 customers. No problem. Each customer sends in two bug reports a year. That's 400 bug reports, 50 engineers, 8 bugs per engineer. No problem. But now you have the same 50 engineers and you have 1 million customers. Or maybe you've expanded your engineering group to 100 engineers and 1 million customers. But that's still 10,000 bug reports per engineer. And now you have a problem. There's no way that those engineers can solve all those bug reports. I used to work for a large computer corporation. And every release, we would have a list of bug reports and enhancements to give to the engineers. And the list might be 350, 400 items long. And the engineers would look at it and say, we can do the top 50. And the rest of them will wait for another release. And so the next release comes along, and instead of everything moving up, some more bug fixes and stuff came in from large customers, customers that you did not want to piss off. And so the small customer was down here, saw their stuff actually pushed down in the queue. With open source, these customers could have made a business decision that they're going to go ahead and fix the problem and find somebody else that could fix it. So that's business side of it. Then there's the government side. Government is a very long-lasting thing, at least we hope. And government also has special needs. A government cannot be held at the mercy of a company because they chose that company's mailing solution. And they can't be at the mercy of a company because they chose some type of database solution and they hold all the data for their country in it. What happens if the company goes out of business? And there's a lot of people say, well, I choose a big company because I know they're going to stay in business a while. Let's take a look at some big companies. WorldCom, Enron, okay, Digital Equipment Corporation, Prime Computer, Wang Computer. In their day, these were all some of the world's largest corporations out of business. You can't depend on that. And even if a company is still in business, they can choose to terminate a product line. Where can you buy Windows 3.1 today? Windows 95, Windows 98. You know, they've all been terminated. Drop support. Recently there was a report that there was a bug in Microsoft Office that if you created a document, you could, when you sent your document to somebody else and they opened it, then you would automatically get back some document from their file systems. And Microsoft acknowledges this as a problem, but they're not going to fix it because they no longer support, you know, Office 97. Well, the problem is that people use Office 97, and they're still using it. So they have no way of fixing this problem. If Microsoft released the source code for Office 97, they could fix that problem. The other thing is that if you're part of a military and you have tanks and airplanes and ships which use an operating system to control them, you don't necessarily want that operating system to be at the mercy of another country's whims. I live in the United States. I love the United States. But every once in a while, it does something strange. And we've had an embargo against Cuba for the last 50 years. We had an embargo against Vietnam for 20 years. We did not ship certain types of computer systems to China until the point that they had gotten so old that we didn't care about them anymore. So China could not get supercomputers from the United States. they had to wait until those supercomputers were about the speed of your Palm Pilot, and then we could ship them. So, you know, encryption. We weren't allowed to ship encryption outside the United States. In fact, the law was so strange that even if the encryption started outside the United States and came into the United States, we couldn't ship it back out of the United States, even to the same country it came from. And these laws, you know, changed and the way that people did work and could do things. With open source, the source code belongs to everybody in the world at the same time. And you can go and get the answers to your problems without being held hostage by some country who doesn't like the way you're doing things this week. And I think that this is something the government should think about. There's another thing government has to think about, and that's something called balance of payments, where a country that is buying proprietary software from another country has to pay a lot of money. And that's money that goes outside of their country and doesn't do anything for anybody inside of their country ever again. And it's one thing that causes. This causes inflation. It causes unemployment. And open source is the way that a country can bring in large pieces of software without having to send their money outside of their country, and use that software with local programmers, creating a local programming industry inside of their own country to solve problems. I was in Russia at St. Petersburg, and there was a man there who was running a turbine modeling thing where people would send ideas for new turbines to them, and they would try them out to see how well they performed. And all the software to do all the testing he had written using open source software. And I asked him how long it had taken him to write this software, and he said, well, if I did it today, it would take me about a year to do it. So this software would probably cost them about $40,000 or $50,000 to create. If he had to buy that software from the United States, it may cost $500,000. In Brazil, they have several different projects that they've started. One of them is called Segu, and it is a university administrative system. It tests students when they first come into the university with their entrance exams. It then follows them all the way through, schedules all of their courses, keeps track of all of their tests, keeps track of all of their grades. When they borrow a book from the library, it goes through Segu. And if they owe money, a library fine for keeping the book too long, that's tracked by Segu. And so the student cannot graduate if they owe any library fines on their books. And their parents, using any web browser, can log into the network and find out exactly where their student is in their coursework. This was developed because they looked at a similar system in the United States, and it would have cost them $60 million to buy it. They decided to build this out of open source software, hiring a local company to do the work, and it cost them the equivalent of $30 million. So they saved $30 million, plus they gave employment to Brazilian programmers who ate Brazilian food, lived in Brazilian houses, and paid Brazilian taxes. So the money stayed inside of Brazil. This was so successful that they went on and they've done other projects. And each project has given them a better product for less money and hired Brazilians to do the work. In Rio de Janeiro, there was a company that is studying the Amazon rainforest for new medicines, new ways of doing things. And the software that they needed to do their work had two problems. It was written in the United States and therefore only prompted in English. Plus, it cost a huge amount of money. They hired a Brazilian programming company to use open source software to duplicate what the software did in the United States. Only it now prompted with Portuguese, and it cost a lot less money. This company does not have any English-speaking people. They would have had to hire an English-speaking person just to use the software from the United States. As it is, they only have to have Portuguese-speaking people. This company could not exist except for open source software. So not only does open source software employ programmers inside, or allow programmers to be employed inside a local economy, but it lowers the barrier to entry for companies so that companies can exist in a local economy that could not exist before. And finally, I have a message for education. The job of a university is to educate responsible electorate. In other words, to make sure that people have the training and knowledge and intelligence to be able to run a country. But also to train people who work for industry and business. Because without trained people, industry and business could not survive in an economy. And a lot of these universities have started teaching courses about how to do business using Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel, you know. And the problem is that when Microsoft changes those products, a lot of the information that these students have from their courses disappears. I think the universities should use open source software to teach their courses, because the student learns much more of the fundamentals that go behind it than they do of just using a particular product. And the second reason, the final thing that universities do, is have research. And research moves the knowledge of human beings forward. In the biotech world right now, we are doing genome research. This requires huge databases of information. And the database engine that they have chosen is MySQL, which is a database engine that is open source. Why did they choose MySQL instead of Oracle? Well, people are doing this work all over the world. And if you say to them, oh yes, you can share my data, but you have to buy an $8,000 Oracle license, all of a sudden it limits the ability of the person in China to help you do your research. It limits the ability of the person in Brazil to help you do your research. On the other hand, with MySQL, you can say to them not only, oh, here's the data, and all you have to do is get MySQL license, which is free, but you can say, here, take the entire image of my disk, database engine, database, data, and everything. And that makes it a lot easier for them to share the data back and forth instead of having to unload it from one database and reload it into another database. This is a type of thing where in doing research, you have to be careful to think about this. Microsoft has what they call a shared source license, which they say will allow people to share the source. Well, their idea of sharing the source is to allow you to look at it, not change it. Secondly, they say, okay, we only allow 30 countries to share the source. It used to be 13. They've expanded it to 30 now. And they say, well, pardon me, Microsoft, but the last time I studied geography, there were 200 countries in the world. So which 170 countries are not going to share the source? I don't know if Slovenia is one of them. you could ask Microsoft whether or not Slovenia can share their source.
I
know that China is not one of them. I know that Brazil is not one of them. I know that South Africa is not one of them. So, you know, if you're in one of these countries, you still don't have access to it. The next thing that Microsoft says is that they will share the source with 1,000 of the top research universities in the world. Well, I used to teach at a small two-year technical college. I don't think that they would have shared the Swiss code with me. AT&T didn't share the Swiss code with me for Unix back in 1980 when I asked for it, because they had a program to give out Unix to all these universities. For my little school, they wanted $160,000 per CPU. And if I had a second CPU, it would only be another $160,000. They didn't believe in quantity discount. And that's a college. What happens in high schools? You have a lot of smart high school students. Can they share the source code with Microsoft? I don't think so. And then finally, Microsoft says, we'll share the source code with 500 of our best business partners. Now, Oracle is a business partner of Microsoft. I wonder if Microsoft will share the source code for SQL with Oracle. Sun Microsystems sells Microsoft products. I wonder if Microsoft would share the source code with Sun. And so I think that this concept of shared source is just a smokescreen to handle the open source people and give Microsoft the illusion of being open. But I think that being that, it's almost worse than if they were completely closed. So I think that those are some of the messages I wanted to bring to both the technical people and to the business people. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Linux has established itself first in education, and because it's cheaper than other software. And in business use, it's only starting to get there with IBM and other big companies supporting it. Do you think it'll ever get to home users?
The home user, it'll take some time. Mm-hmm. The home user has a different support structure than the industrial desktop user. Mm-hmm. In industry, when you're particularly a large company, you have a systems administrator who installs your system. So a new person comes to work for the company, the systems administrator shows up, they've got the system, everything is installed, they plug it in, that's what you use. And if that happens with Linux, the same thing could be done, because the system administrator would set up the system, install all the products that was needed, make all the menus pop up properly, bring the system there and install it. In industry, when you have a problem, the first person you talk to is the person who's sitting next to you, because they may have had the same problem and know how to fix it. But after that, you call the systems administrator, and they help you fix the problem. The person at home has a different support structure. They have a problem. They don't call. There's no system administrator to call up. And if they do call anybody, they probably call somebody at their church they know also has a computer, and they're going to ask them. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they ask the person down the street or next door. And in the very worst possible case, they ask their children. Because, you know, children, they always look at you with disdain when you ask these questions for some reason. So until Linux moves more into the schools and until more people are using it at work, it's harder for the at-home person to get that support. But this is exactly what happened with PCs in the first place. And I think that as Linux gets more and more place on the desktop at work, then it will naturally flow to the home.
And how do you view this certain open source projects which seem to be less open source, like Lindos, for example?
I think that Lindos, the wonderful thing about open source projects is that these type of problems seem to be self-correcting. And because there are so many distributions out there, because Wine is a project which is open, I think that there will be other people who will come along and create the equivalent of Lindos and make it completely open. And then Lindos will either have to make their project completely open or they will just vanish. Now, I am not completely familiar with Lindos and how it was put together, but it may be some type of real legal reason why the Lindos people cannot make their project completely open. This is the same reason that companies like Digital Equipment Corporation could not just make their operating system open source. It's because we had all these business deals with other companies that said that, yes, we were going to protect their source code and not show it to people. And to go back and renegotiate all those business deals, sometimes with companies that didn't even exist anymore, was hard. So it could be that Lindos is using some technology which they purchased from somebody to make this work, and they can't legally expose this. That's a possibility. I don't know. So there are these issues. But, again, from what I've seen, it's like the case with the sound drivers, the original sound drivers. The person who wrote them said, oh, I'm going to write these sound drivers, and now I'm going to create this private business over here which will add value-added enhancements to it, but they're not going to be open source. And this pissed off the Linux community, so they started the ALSA project as an alternative. And now ALSA is better than the original sound drivers. And in the next kernel, the old sound drivers are going to be replaced by ALSA. Mm-hmm. So these things tend to be self-correcting over time. And I think that some of these other issues will be self-correcting also. You can do that when you have choice, when the choice allows you to move to a different version or a different operating system. Mm-hmm. And we'll see what happens.
There's been some analysts saying that Linux isn't good for very big systems like mainframes, and IBM is still pushing it, the limits on the Z servers. What's your view? I mean, okay, it can work on a PDA, it can work on a PC, but is there the limit with the mainframe systems that Linux might not be the appropriate choice?
Well, first of all, you have to take a look at the way that IBM is using Linux on their mainframe. They have a mainframe computer in which they run VM, virtual machine. And in one section of the virtual machine, they run maybe MVS and DB2 as a database. Then on other sections of the virtual machine, they run Linux, and they run the Apache web server or whatever, and DB2 generates data which is then distributed across the web by these web servers running in these individual virtual machines. So Linux, in that case, what Linux sees is, oh, I'm running on a single processor system with a uniform memory space. It's not any different. And I've got some I/O devices underneath me, and in effect, I'm running on a very large PC, so it runs very efficiently. Mm-hmm. This is Linux running on a mainframe. Now let's take another look at what could be a mainframe of 64 processors. Mm-hmm. Now you say, well, Linux doesn't really scale well above 10 processors. So would Linux run really well on this type of a system? And the answer is probably no. Because it doesn't scale that well above 10 processors. But when you take a look at a system that has 64 processors, it's typically not 64 processors on the same bus. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, maybe 8 processors on this bus, 8 processors on this, and so forth, and they're all hooked together with high-speed networking. Mm-hmm. And maybe a crossbar switch or something like that. And we call this non-uniform memory. Well, Linux does not have support in it today for non-uniform memory. But that project is being worked on by a group of companies called OSDL, Open Source Development Labs, which have banded together to try and make this happen. It's being worked on by companies like SGI. It's being worked on by companies like, you know, Sun Microsystems and others. And I think that Linux will eventually run well on these types of NUMA systems. SGI, for instance, recently announced that they had run a very high-scale benchmark using Linux, and it had scaled very nicely on their 64-processor NUMA machine. Of course, that's an announcement, so whether or not, you know, it goes on and is borne out by, you know, real loads and things like that, we'll have to see. The second thing is that when you're talking about symmetrical multiprocessing, a lot of it depends on the type of load you've got. If you're doing lots of I.O., then a lot of times SMP systems will fall down a little bit. If you're doing very CPU-intensive jobs, then even the worst of SMP systems will shine very nicely. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that each time a CPU is scheduled, they get a full time quantum of time allocated mm-hmm. to them. So, you know, it depends on the load and everything else. I think that Sun is trying to protect a little bit their Solaris product. And I think they're a little defensive of trying to say, well, this is the reason why you should be buying Spark and Solaris, when a lot of people are saying, gee, maybe we should be buying Intel and Linux. Mm-hmm. Still, there are certain things which are not in the Linux kernel yet, which a lot of people think of when they think of as high availability computing. For example, I have a system that has 64 CPUs in it, and one of the CPUs starts to go bad. I should be able to unschedule that CPU, pull that CPU out, put a new one in, and put that CPU scheduled back in again without shutting the machine down. I have a disk controller that's beginning to go bad. I should be able to put the load of that disk controller over to another disk controller. I should then be able to take that disk controller out and put another one in. That's a little bit harder problem because you may have lots of IOs which are still outstanding on that disk controller. These type of things, again, are things that commercial Unix systems can do, and they've taken a lot of engineering time and effort to do it, and we have plans to do it for Linux, but they're just not done yet. 2.5 will have a lot of these features in it, and I think that probably some more features will be coming in later versions of the kernel. In the meantime, my message back to Sun is that there's a big difference between whether Linux is ready for enterprise computing or whether the enterprise is ready for Linux. And I think there's many places in enterprise today where Linux can be used right out of the box and be useful and cut costs and allow you to unload your expensive mainframe computers that are doing these trivial tasks like web serving and allow them to be put on a less expensive system and, you know, one that can do the same job at a much lower cost. I think that's what industry is finding out also.
And where do you see Sun within Linux? It's announced its own version.
I would not have advised Sun to put out their own version of Linux. I think that there already is a large number of Linux distributions that are very good. And I think that Sun is just going to spend a lot of money and maybe not get anything better. I think that some of these distributions have earned a very loyal following that Sun does not have in the Linux space. And I think that it might have been better for them to take one of these distributions and add things to it to give value added to their customers rather than just reinvent the wheel again.
Yeah, because IBM decided against it a few years back when it decided to support Linux. It didn't put out its own version.
And so did Hewlett-Packard, and so did, you know, various other companies. And a lot of that was on my advice. And I said, look, in the Linux space, Linux people like a distribution because of various reasons. Red Hat was very strong in the United States, but SUSE was very strong in Germany and a lot of other places. Mm-hmm. And so if Compaq Computer Corporation had chosen Red Hat as their partner and then tried to go to Germany and sell it, they would have lost business. Mm-hmm. But by going in and saying, okay, we're going to support both Red Hat and SUSE, now it gives their customers choice. And now the customers can say, okay, I've been using SUSE so far with my notebooks and things. I'll buy a Compaq server with SUSE on it. So, that was what they heard, and that was the way they acted. And I think the Sun, particularly at this point, of saying, well, we're going to do our own distribution, is probably more of arrogance than anything else.
What about the United Linux movement?
Okay. Now, this is the bad part of all the distributions. The good part of all the distributions is that it gives you a wide variety of different features and things you can choose from. The bad part of all the distributions happens in two places. Number one, the independent software vendor, the person making shrink wrap software that they want to sell. Let's say they do the development on SUSE and they say, okay, it works fine. Now they take it to Red Hat, and Red Hat has moved a little file a little bit. Or they've changed the contents of one of the files, so it's slightly different. Or they're using a different version of the libraries, and the application doesn't run. And so the application vendor then has to change it and redistribute their application. This has started to happen. And about 3 or 4 years ago, but some of the members of Linux International got together and said, we have to stop this from happening. So we started a project called the Linux Standard Base. And it was actually started by one of our members, Bruce Perens, and he had the encouragement and backing of Linux International members. So we started the project, and actually it was just recently that the project came to version 1.0. And a lot of the different vendors have been following it all along. Several of them have passed the initial test suites. And this will help. It doesn't necessarily 100% guarantee, but it helps to guarantee that an application that is developed in one distribution will work on another distribution, which is LSB compliant. So we're going to continue improving the test suites, improving the definition, making it better. And hopefully at one time, an ISV will just say, okay, I'll build my application on this one. I will assume it'll work on all the others, and I'll put it out. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's some tiny little nit that will happen, but we probably could create a workaround for that rather than a whole recoding of the mm-hmm. problem. Now, that's the first part, so ISVs. The second problem comes with hardware vendors. I'm IBM, and I say to my customers, what distribution you want? And they say, well, I'd like to have Red Hat. So I send my system out there, and it doesn't work for some reason. Do my customers go back to Red Hat and say, hey, Red Hat, you bunch of bums, it doesn't work on IBM? They come to IBM. So IBM, as a vendor, has to be very careful that the distribution works on top of their equipment, as stated. So they do a lot of testing. Well, it's one thing to test Linux. It's another thing to test Red Hat and SUSE and Caldera and Turbo Linux and Red Flag Linux and Fat Linux and everything else, you know. And so they said, gee, you know, we're going to test 1, 2, maybe 3 distributions. And so a lot of the smaller distributions like Turbo Linux and everybody else said, all right, we're going to band together and we're going to create one larger distribution from the viewpoint of these hardware vendors and also from the viewpoint of the software vendors. And all the specifications that are mentioned in the LSB, we will make sure they come from exactly the same source code tree and exactly the same compilers. So this guarantees that if you develop an application on any one of our systems, it'll run on all the rest of United Linux systems. The other thing is that we will have one installation so that if IBM installs any one of our distributions on their hardware, then all the rest of our distributions will also install. And then the question is, how do we differentiate? Well, they differentiate because they have different added-on things that they'll be supplying, or they have different support policies, or any number of different ways that vendors differentiate. The same way as, how do you differentiate when you're using Microsoft? You know, Microsoft NT is Microsoft NT. So if you're a hardware vendor, what is your differentiation? Well, it's a lot easier to differentiate with Linux than it is to differentiate with Windows. And so they figure, hey, if we can differentiate with, you know, Windows, we can certainly find ways to differentiate with Linux. So United Linux, from the viewpoint of what they're doing, is very good. Now, I've heard that there are some issues with United Linux about some of the things that they're doing people feel are not exactly GPL. And again, I haven't had time to look into and investigate all of that. But once again, the marketplace will help to fix that problem, because the marketplace will say, no, we want a completely open solution. These things which you're holding back is not good enough. We're going to go use Red Hat. And that, again, this is where choice and competition comes in. It's an important part of open source, is choice and competition. It helps to keep the prices down and helps to tell the vendors that, you know, that the consumer still has some power.
But still, do you think that, going back to home users, do you think they actually care about it being open source, or do you think they care more about it being cheaper and having good support and having it work, even if it meant it wasn't open source?
Well, I think that for the average home user, the average home user doesn't even want to have to think about the operating system.
Yeah.
The average home user just wants to be able to play games and whatever. But the issue around that is that it has to work. And the average home user does not want to be in the middle of playing a really great game and have the whole operating system collapse around them. So for the average home user, what they're looking for is the stability and the capabilities of the operating system, even if they can't really voice what they want. I have a Palm Pilot. And the Palm Pilot, when I want to cut information from one application and paste it in another, I start up one application, I take the information, I then start up the other application, which kills the first one, I paste the information into the second application. I have to go back to the first application, go back to where I was, cut some more information, go back to the second application, go to where I want to go, paste it in. That's because it's single tasking. On the other hand, I have a Sharp Zaris, which runs Linux. I start up both applications at the same time, and I just flip between the windows. Cut, paste, cut, paste, cut, paste. That's multitasking. Even if I was a customer or an end user that didn't know how the operating system worked or why it did that, I would look at the second one and say, oh, that's much easier to use. Mm-hmm. That's what I want.
Yes, but also my iPad with Windows does that too.
Yes. I wasn't necessarily saying that this was a comparison between
open source or
Microsoft or any particular operating systems. I was trying to give you an example that the operating system does make a difference even to the home user. They may not be able to state in words or technical reasons why this happens, but they do see, you know, a happening. And it may not be this simple example which I gave, it may be something else which the home user sees and says, oh, I like this operating system better. I think right now, if you go out to SourceForge out on the net, you'll find out that there's about 47,000 different open source projects and about 500,000 people who have registered to work on them. And a lot of people say, well, a lot of these projects will never come to anything, or a lot of these projects are duplicates of each other. They'll say a lot of these people have login accounts on SourceForge just to say they do. Most of the people only put in 1 hour a week. But on the other hand, even if only 10% of those projects and 10% of those people really amount to something, that's still 4,700 projects and 40,000 programmers, which is larger than any company has. Microsoft has about 35,000 employees, and 34,950 of those are sales and marketing. So, you know, you can see that the number of brain power that's out there on the open source marketplace is huge. Now, think about what happens as China comes on board and as they get more connected to the internet. Or think what happens as India comes more on board. And think about all those people that are today using Microsoft and say, tomorrow I'm going to use open source. And oh, by the way, I can contribute something. So instead of just having 500,000 people, we might have 3 million people, 4 million people contributing to open source. And I think when you take a look at some of the products which have come out of the open source space and say, these are really good, that what's going to happen in the future, assuming that the momentum keeps going, is that there's going to be some absolutely phenomenal software come out. And it's software that have all the open source available so that people can make the changes that they need to make to it, to make it fit their business, so they don't have to change their business to fit the way the software works.
Yeah, although that still is probably going to hold true, like for SAP and these big ERP systems, you have to change your business to work with SAP.
Only because they have not had enough programmers to be able to make their software fit the needs of every business. I mean, SAP is an extremely complex piece of software, but so is most business.
Yeah.
And to try and make SAP meet every business needs would have had to require engineers 10 times the number. But let's change SAP's business model slightly for them. Let's say that instead of making software that works all the way down for every business purpose, that they create core pieces of software which allow a consultant to come in and extend that software down to exactly the way that the company works. And this might be a completely different model for them. And certain parts of this of their code they might make open source, because that makes it easier for the VAR to do their work. Other pieces of software they would make closed source, because that is the value added that they give, the proprietary intellect that they give. Mm-hmm. I don't think in the future that all software will be open source. And I can give an example where I think that it won't be. You take a look at source code and then the world computer market. Here is the list of all the people who use computers. Mm-hmm. And most of those people have an operating system on it. I say most of them because there are some embedded systems and things that don't use operating systems. They write directly. Then, if you're using an operating system, there's quite a few people who have at least made use of a compiler. And so compilers are very important to the world of computing. And then you can say, well, gee, there's a lot of people that use some type of database of one type or another. But now you start to get into software which is more vertical, because you start to say health services, and you start to say police software, and you start to say fire department software, and banking software, and you say, you know, and all these different types of vertical software. Mm-hmm. Well, this is kind of where open source got its beginning in the first place. Why? Because when you have millions of people who need the software, then perhaps you have thousands of people who are willing to, or hundreds of thousands who would like to see it changed, thousands that have the capability of changing it, and maybe 500 or 600 which have the capability, the desire, and the time to do it. Mm-hmm. But when you get into these markets, it's a lot less, fewer people who use the software, who create the software, and who can change it. We are beginning to see some vertical markets where people go in and create software that does something nice, like GIMP, you know, graphical image manipulation software, audio software for combining music. Why? Because you have amateur musicians who are also amateur computer programmers who combine their two talents and say, I'm going to create open source software that does this. You have, or even you have professional musicians who are amateur computers or whatever. So these are starting to come in. Now, where will you not see open source software? When there's only one person in the world, or two people in the world, who have an interest in a particular piece of software. They're direct competitors, and this one develops a piece of software that allows him to sell his products to his customers for 50% less. He's probably not going to make his software open source so his competitor can use it. Mm-hmm. Closed source proprietary software. Let's take a look at our police departments. In a lot of ways, police departments compete with each other. The police department of New York City likes to say we have lower crime than Chicago. But on the other hand, they also cooperate with each other. And so here's a perfect place where the police departments could come together and say, we're going to hire a company to do completely open source software to benefit 15 or 20 police departments across the United States who have much the same types of needs and problems. We're going to put the whole thing as open source out onto the net. So the police department of Paris can use it. The police department of you know, and they will add things to it too. And now this software is going to be really fantastic. It's going to cover a whole range of needs, and it's still going to be less money than if we went out and brought proprietary software that did the same thing. Hospitals are the same way. Doctors are the same way. Lawyers are the same way. And all they need to do is get one central organization to come together and say, we're going to coordinate this. collect some money from each one of these different groups and put this together. And it's going to start. And the cost of providing these services is going to start to come down. Or the efficiency of these different groups is going to start to go up. And this is what could be done with open source projects. This is what Brazil is beginning to understand. And if a police, if a particular police department needs a particular special piece of code for them, then they can hire somebody to write it and integrate it because they've got the source code to everything else. So there's a lot of these different types of groups. And I call this co-opetition. Mm-hmm. It's cooperation amongst people who compete on some level, but not directly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that SAP will be around for a long time because there's a lot of people who have changed their business to the way SAP works. That was a business decision they made. But I think that if an open source solution could be generated that would have much the same type of capabilities, they might not make that same business decision the same way.
Anybody else?
How about European Union embracing open source solutions?
I think it's a wonderful idea. I mean, you know, again, there's a lot of issues in government which are the same. And I think that the European Union coming together and trying to do things like say, well, let's use the same money, okay? We're going to have a situation where we have a lot of small entities and police departments, but oh, by the way, we want to cut down on the borders that we have. You know, we want to cut down on the inner border problems we have. So this means that more people are going to be able to travel easier from our different countries. So now I have a police department in this country that uses one piece of proprietary software, and I have a piece of a police department in this country that uses another piece, and they wouldn't be able to transfer information back, like suspected terrorists or, you know, somebody who's been stealing money from banks and attacking banks in one country now is going to go attack banks in another country. Well, you wouldn't be able to share information like that. You know, things like fire departments. You know, there's street maps and things. And along the borders of these countries, they start to become problems. Well, now you could create one piece of software that it didn't make exactly which country you were in. It would still work. And I think that there's, and just the sharing of these costs would help to cut the cost of government down. I know there's a lot of people who are very cynical about government and whether or not government tries to cut costs. But sometimes they really do.
I have a question. I mean, if the EU decided to adopt Linux instead of Microsoft and Lotus, which, I mean, at least our country generally uses, don't you think that the US would have a problem with that as a country? Because it would get less in taxes from Microsoft revenues.
Well, first of all, it's funny because the richer you are, the fewer taxes you pay. I don't know how much taxes Mr. Gates pays or whether he pays any taxes at all. Because he may have tax accountants who are so good that he never pays any taxes. This has always been the issue of the rich. But there's another aspect of finance and economics. And I get asked this question a lot, by the way. Is it better to have one $80 billion heir or have 80 billion $1 heirs? Is it better to have 80,000 millionaires or one person who's worth $80 billion? We have a slogan in the United States which says, think locally, globally and act locally. Well, Microsoft is the opposite of that. They're acting only in one tiny little place, Redmond, Washington. Yes, there are stores that sell Microsoft, there are stores, but they could sell other things too. They don't have to sell just Microsoft. Now, the problem, even in the United States, is if you're a programmer working in Virginia, does the fact, you know, you send money to Redmond, Washington. If you're a programmer in Florida, you send money to Redmond, Washington. So all the different governments of all these states would much rather have some of that money being spent in their state. Just like different countries of the world in sending money to the U.S. would much rather have that money spent in their country. So what I'm saying is the governments should think globally but act locally. And that's what open source allows them to do. Think globally as working together on this global project, but act locally because the money they're paying to tailor that open source software is paid to people in their country who are their programmers and buy their food, their housing, their taxes. Now, if the economy of the United States was so simple that we could say, all right, Microsoft isn't making as much money this year, the whole United States economy is going to collapse, then we would not need Alan Greenspan, who is our director of the Treasury, right? The economy is not that simple. If Slovenia did not send, let's say, $100 million to the United States every year to Redmond, Washington, maybe they would spend $50 million on other products that the United States makes because they would have that $100 million here. What would happen if Slovenia did not send the $100 million and instead spent that money here? Well, now the people in Slovenia have more money to generate more things. Gee, you might even generate more revenue to purchase things from the United States. These are things that, you know, really have to be worked out. And I don't think that, number one, the economy of the United States would collapse because all of a sudden everybody wasn't buying Microsoft products. And number two, I think that the ability of countries to generate their own computer science economy and industry would far outweigh the issue of not sending that money to the United States. Now, whether that's true or not, we'll only find out by trying. But I'm willing to make the bet.
You already mentioned this Linux standards base. I wonder whether there is a reason that different distributions use different file systems, not file systems, but directory structure. The distributions really differ in these small things. What is your opinion on that?
Well, first of all, again, in my experience of being in the computer industry for 30 years, there is only one thing which sells an operating system, and that is applications. If you don't have the right applications, the person will not buy your operating system. And sometimes it's only one application. And they'll say, oh, you have all the other applications I want, but you don't have this one application, therefore I can't buy your operating system. And then you have to go to that application vendor and beg them to port to your operating system. And they'll say, well, my application works on all these other operating systems. Why doesn't it work on yours? And you say, well, I had to make my file system different. And they go, well, I don't like the way you've done it. And I'm sorry. You know, that was your business choice to make your file system different. It's his business choice. He doesn't want to support it. And, you know, that's the problem. I don't think that there's anything in the LSB. In fact, the vendors that have endorsed it and helped to write it have, in fact, said that, which is absolutely imperative to having, you know, to forcing them not to do business the way they want to do business.
Mm-hmm. Now, this Unified Linux group consists of SUSE and other Red Hat is out, so it appears like being an opposition versus Red Hat.
I was told by the United Linux people that they had asked Red Hat if they wanted to join, and Red Hat declined. Now, I mean, there's many reasons for that. Red Hat may feel that as a market leader, they do not necessarily have to join a United Linux front. They may feel that the model which has been created, which is basically that SUSE is going to do all of the engineering work for this base product, maybe Red Hat felt that was too limiting for what they needed to do for their customers. And I don't know the reasons why Red Hat said no. But according to United Linux, they also asked Mandrake, and Mandrake said no. SOT, I'm not sure whether they were asked or not, but they are not part of United Linux. Red Flag is not part. But I think the most important thing from the United Linux point is, if these companies wanted to join, would they be allowed to join on an equal and legitimate basis? And if the answer to that is yes, then United Linux is doing everything right. If the answer to that is no, then United Linux is not open. And that's a problem, I would think. But according, I do know that Red Hat was asked very late in the process of creating United Linux. So, you know, it was like within days of United Linux making their announcement that Red Hat was asked. But I have it on very good terms that Red Hat was asked at the last moment and they declined. Mm-hmm. Maybe over time they'll change their mind. I don't know.
What about the trouble that Turbo Linux has been seeing? I mean, they closed up their U.S. operations, just focusing on Asia. There's another thing. We in Europe, how big? We don't know this. How big is Turbo Linux in Asia? Because they say they're the main distribution. What is that actually?
Well, first of all, Turbo Linux, although they've always had a presence in the United States, has always been focused on Asia. Okay, their big claim was that they were supporting Japanese and, you know, Chinese and
Korean
and, you know, various other Asian languages. Now, they also supported U.S. and their head offices were in Utah. But, you know, from everything I've seen, they were focusing on Asia. Now, along comes Red Flag, and Red Flag is being sponsored by the Chinese government. And the Chinese government actually funds a university to do all the development for Red Flag. And at Red Flag, the company only has about 40 engineers who put together the project and do the documentation and do the packaging and things like that. So it would be, you know, I think the Chinese government is putting a lot of money into Linux through funding of this university. And it would be pretty hard for any company to really stand up to that. How much of their business, you know, according to Lu Bo of Red Flag, Turbo Linux is maybe 7% of the Chinese market, and Red Flag is probably about 80%, with Red Hat making up the rest. If you talk with Turbo Linux, they're doing much better. And a lot of this is because there's also these smaller distributions that will grab a copy of Turbo Linux and they'll change it and they'll say it's our distribution. It's like Red Hat saying they're the world leader. Well, what they're saying is Red Hat, along with all the cheap bytes and the other people who copy their code and redistribute it, and Red Hat never gets a penny, makes Red Hat the world leader, not necessarily the boxes of Red Hat that they sell out the door, or even the systems that are copied over the net. This has caused, of course, a lot of smaller distributions to disappear. And it may be that Turbo Linux disappears because there is also at least a couple of Korean versions that are out there that come out of Korea. Hankam Office comes out of Korea. So there seems to be a very strong Korean Linux community right there. Japanese have a couple of different distributions besides Turbo Linux. The other thing that Turbo Linux was concentrating on for a while was cluster support. And it may be that this might be the niche where they could make money and survive. But a lot of these different Linux companies, they started up and either A, they miscalculated what the market was going to be at a certain time frame. B, they got bad management in there. C, they chose bad financing through venture capitalists. There's a reason why venture capitalists are called VCs. It's because just like in Vietnam, they would come springing out of the woods, and just the time you turned it back, they'd stab you. Well, venture capitalists, they want to put their money in, and they expect to get their money back tomorrow with 15 times the interest. And this is not what the Linux marketplace was about. The Linux marketplace was steady growth over a long period of time. And so the venture capitalists said, oh, well, now we have to somehow sell off our interest and get our money back. And that's why you see a lot of these small companies like LinuxCare basically go down the tubes. VA Linux Systems did the same thing. I always questioned when Larry Augustin was setting up VA Linux Systems. I said, okay, Larry, you're selling computer systems. You've got 130 people in your company, and you're trying to compete with IBM. Tell me how this is going to work again. IBM goes in, sets up a line to make PCs, and they make 400,000 units. So they buy their parts 400,000 at a time. They set up the line in Taiwan where they get really inexpensive labor, and they make all these systems. And now they say, oh, we want to make some systems for Linux too. Okay. Add another 100 systems onto that 400,000 systems, and those will be Linux systems. Larry has to go out and negotiate a contract for those 100 systems. He has to buy space in San Jose, California, some of the most expensive places on the face of the earth. He has to hire very expensive people, and he's going to compete with IBM or Compaq. When they were very small and none of these large companies wanted to sell products with Linux on it, when Linux was small, Larry could compete because he sold to people who wanted to buy Linux and wanted to get support. And they were willing to pay a premium for that. But just as soon as the large volume manufacturers started to say Linux, then a lot of his customers went and said, hey, I can get the same box from IBM for a lot less money than VA will charge for it. In fact, towards the end, IBM was selling at list price for the same amount of money as it took Larry to manufacture it. So he couldn't make any money at all. So, bad business plans. When Linux was a niche market, Larry could make money. When Linux became mainstream, he could not.
If you got big enough, well, it was still a niche.
Yeah, but, you know, Unfortunately for Larry, Linux grew too quickly. Fortunately for the Linux community, Linux grew quickly.
What would be your idea of a killer application on Linux? We now discussed only Linux as a kernel, as an operating system, and now what is your opinion on applications that run on, also on Linux?
Killer application.
Yeah.
A Microsoft virus spreader.
That would be a killer.
Unfortunately, Microsoft has already written that, and they call it Windows XP. I don't know. I don't know what a killer application is, really. Every time somebody says I've got a killer application, sometimes it takes off and sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. But look back in history. WordStar was a killer application. SuperCalc was a killer application. I mean, they changed the way that people looked at computers and used them. Certainly, web browsers and web servers were killer applications. So, and I don't think that any killer application is going to confine itself only to Linux. Because just as soon as people understand what the killer application is, they're going to put it to every operating system that's out there that they can. So, you know, I think that the day that a killer application that only exists in one system is probably over with. Now, what I would like to do is to make Linux the design center of choice. And we used to do this many years ago with operating systems like MVS and stuff like that. We'd have a great bunch of application development tools that sat on that that made it easy for an application developer to develop an application. So they developed the application on VMS, and then they ported it to other operating systems. And this is the way that the Ingress database was done and a whole series of other projects. The advantage of doing this was that the best applications always appeared on VMS first. And so if we could create a software development platform for Linux that you could look a Microsoft Windows developer in the face and say to them truthfully, develop your application on Linux, and then you could just say compile for Windows and it'll work, then why shouldn't they develop on Linux? And then when they develop on Linux, they could develop the same, have the same application, the same source code, say compile for Linux, compile for Windows, put it onto the same CD, distribute it in the same box with a little Windows symbol and a little penguin. And people go to the store, the box is taking up exactly the same space in the shelf. There's no reason for the store vendor to get rid of it because he hasn't sold any. They bring it out, they say, oh, this works both on Windows and Linux. Great, I'll take it home, put it on my Linux system. But right now, you go to the United States, for a while, a lot of these stores were carrying boxes of Linux, but there was nothing else that they could sell. And so, after a while, it started getting smaller and smaller on the shelves. The other thing is that Linux people, they typically don't buy Linux directly from a store. They either pull it over the net or they order it over the net. And so these stores would have these boxes of Linux sitting there on the shelf for a long time. And it become old and they had to return it. That was the other thing. We keep coming out with all these distributions of Linux really fast and the guy just gets SUSE 8.0 on the shelf. And 8.1 is out. People go, it's 8.0, it's old. Why should I pay you for old software when this new stuff is out? Look how long that Windows 98 was out. And yes, they had a second edition. But you never heard anything except second edition is out. Look how long second edition was out. But the open source community says that's bad because it's all these neat things that are coming in. You've got to have all this neat stuff coming in. So for the shopkeeper, it's hard keeping up with that. And there's nothing else for them to sell. You know, they want to sell Oracle on top of Linux, and they want to sell all this other stuff to make more money. So we have to change this somehow. And what we have to do is we have to get the shopkeeper, instead of just selling layered products that come in boxes, to sell services to people of tailoring their software to what they really want. Mm-hmm. It has to change into much more of a service industry.
I have two more questions. If you
don't mind. But you can ask the questions the whole week. These guys only get to ask questions right now.
Right.
Is it okay?
Okay.
But if they object, you can't ask your question.
The first would be, there are a lot of Office packages right now, like OpenOffice and so on, KOffice. What would be your comment on the emergence of such a number of different Office packages?
The only thing that I would say is I think that it would be great if the open source community could come together and figure out one format for Office Interchange, whether it's a document or a spreadsheet or a presentation. And then I think having multiple Office products is really great because it gives people the chance to try out different features, and there's some competition there. So when OpenOffice sees a nice feature in KOffice, they can say, okay, we're going to copy the functionality and put it in. There is a downside to that, and that comes in the case of people who are trying to teach office skills to people who are trying to be some secretaries or people. And they say, well, we can only teach one Office product. And right now the default Office product to be taught is Microsoft Office. And for business people, this is a problem because the business person wants to hire a temporary worker or they want to hire somebody new to come in, and that person has to learn their Office system, whether it be, OpenOffice or KOffice or Microsoft Office or whatever. So the business person, in a lot of cases, says, I want to see one Office product so I don't have to spend the first day of anybody coming in learning a new Office product. Well, to this person, I have a question. I say to them, are you trying to tell me that the people that you hire are so smart that they can help you run your business, but are so stupid that they can't learn a word processor or at least be functional in one in less than a day? Is that what you're trying to tell me? And they say, well, no, that's not exactly what I'm trying to tell you. And I says, well, that's what I heard. And I've even run into this in universities. Universities say, well, we want to train people on how to use Microsoft Office so that they can get a job when they leave the university. I go, oh, so you're trying to tell me that your students are smart enough to learn a course like compiler theory or operating system design or database design, but they're too stupid to be able to read the little manual in Microsoft Word to be able to figure out how to use it in a day. They go, well, no, that's not exactly what we're saying. I says, yes, it is. That's exactly what you're saying. And I, on the other hand, will come back to them and say, if you teach a particular product and that product changes or the product line goes away, then in effect, I should be able to reach into that student's transcript and pull that course out and say they never took it because everything they learned in that course is now obsolete. Mm-hmm. I, on the other hand, when I went to college, I learned fundamentals. And 30 years later, I still use those fundamentals in my day-to-day work. And things which are opaque to a lot of other people are transparent to me because I have these fundamentals. Universities should be teaching fundamentals. They should be teaching a course like comparative office system design to let people see what are the differences between these different office systems and how to use them. rather than this is a specific product and how you use it. Mm. So there are these problems, but I think that in order for society to move forward, and again, to have competition, I believe, is good. And it's good to have competing office products. And, you know, again, I mean, I could switch between K-Office, OpenOffice, StarOffice, AppExWare, and Microsoft Word with very little confusion, particularly for the type of, you know, writing a simple letter, doing a simple resume and stuff. If I was a professional secretary, I might spend the time to learn two or three of them and therefore make myself more valuable to management.
Mm-hmm. The last question, do you play any computer games?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't have any time to do that. And I actually have no inclination. When I was teaching, my students would ask me if they could play games on the computer, but back in those days, I said, no, we have people waiting for terminals and stuff. I don't want you wasting the time. If you'd like to learn how to, if you'd like to program a game, if you want to learn how games work, perfectly fine. I'll give you all the computer time you want. But just playing a game, no. I do admit that I play solitaire from time to time on my Zaris when I'm waiting for an airplane, but that's about it.
That's all. For my part.
Is it true that you wear Linux underwear?
Only once. Somebody gave me a pair of underwear with penguins on it, and I did wear it one time, but no, I wear jockey shorts briefly. I do have lots of penguins on different pieces of clothing, but I don't normally wear penguin underwear.
Have you seen a penguin in a wild environment?
Yes, I have. In Melbourne, Australia. There's a little, there's these fairy penguins. They're even smaller than that. They're only about that tall. Whenever they walk across the beach and they come to a little pebble about that size, they'll stop. And it's like they're trying to make a decision. Do I climb over it or do I walk around it? And sometimes they decide to walk around it, and sometimes they try and climb over it. Climbing over it is hard. No. And then there was a time that we had some penguins that this company called Magic Software, they brought these penguins to a trade show. And they were very, very, very good to the penguins. These penguins have been used in TV advertisements and things like that. So the penguins were very used to having a lot of people around and lights and everything. And they had a hotel room for the penguins. The penguins had a swimming pool, a plastic swimming pool, set up inside of the hotel room. There was a fenced-in area that the penguins were allowed to go on, and there was newspaper down, so that every time the penguin went to the bathroom, there was somebody there ready to put a new piece of newspaper immediately down on top of it so the penguins didn't have to walk in their own, you know, sewage. They had frozen fish in a little basket for them. And then when we took them to the show, they had a little carrying case for the penguins, and the penguins were only allowed to be outside the carrying case for 1.5 hours at a time, and then they got to be back in the carrying case for about 1 hour or so to rest. And then there was another showing of the penguins for about 30 minutes, right? And so two stories came out of this. The first one is, months later, I was receiving these letters from people or reading these things on the net about these live penguins and how horrible it was that we were using these penguins, you know, and the animal rights groups were all against us and everything. And I particularly remember this one letter that said, the penguins' eyes were wide with fear. I said, pardon me, penguins swim underwater looking for fish. Their eyes are always wide, but it's not fear. They're looking for fish. No, it's underwater. It's dark. They're looking for fish, So that was the first one. And then the second story is that here we were all set up to do this, right? And the penguins were in their little cage, and there was a guard sitting there to make sure that nobody disturbed the penguins. When these two guys came up and asked if they could see the penguins. And the guard said, no, they're in the cage, they'll be out in another hour, you could see them then. Meanwhile, I was over in the digital booth, and I just could not stand this any longer, so I came over and said, hello. This first person is Dirk Holmdahl, and he's the head of the X386 project. And, you know, that's bad enough. But the second guy is Linus Torvalds. And if it wasn't for him, none of this stuff in this whole show would be here, including you and the penguins. And the guy says, oh. And so he opens up the door and lets the penguins out, and Linus looks at them and goes, oh, thank you very much. And put the penguins back in. And a little while later, this woman comes up with this little baby carriage, and in it are two little girls, and she stops, and she would like to look at the penguins. And the guy says, no, they're in the cage, they'll be out in another hour. So I come over again and said, hi, remember the guy that none of this stuff would be here if it wasn't for him? He says, this is his wife and his children. But neither one of them, neither Linus nor Tuve, would say, hey, you know, if it wasn't for me, none of this stuff would be here. Show me the damn penguins. Because it's just not in their nature to do that. Linus is not a very, in those type of things, he's just not forceful and, you know, and demanding or anything else, right? Mm-hmm. He, you know, he's, okay, penguins will be out another hour. I'll come back then from wherever I am and take a look at them. Fortunately for him, I'm not so shy and you know. Well, thank you very much for coming, and I hope that you got some information for your readers. Okay.
I would like to thank you too also for taking the time to be here.